everybody. I'm Ben Swan, filling in for Rick Sanchez. This is Direct Impact, and here's just one of the stories we're covering today.
What I think about Curse, bold, brilliant, beautiful. Keep it up.
A U.S. senator calling recent fighting that resulted in over 1,000 soldiers dead on both sides of the Russia-Ukraine conflict beautiful, all before trying to recruit civilians from NATO member countries to join the fight. I'm Ben Swan. This is Direct Impact. And thanks for being with us today. More on the words of that U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham in just a moment. But first, we begin with the U.S. presidential race today. Donald Trump, the Republican candidate, just had a two-hour chat with Elon Musk on the social platform X. It did not start off smoothly, by the way. The event was delayed by over 40 minutes due to what Musk said was a cyber attack. But when they finally got going, more than a million listeners tuned in at a time to hear the conversation. And that conversation touched on various topics. The former president did not shy away from taking jabs at his Democratic competition.
What I can tell you is this. We cannot have a Democrat. We cannot have her. She's incompetent. She's as bad as Biden in a different...
Yeah.
Look, she hasn't done an interview since this whole scam started. And say what you want. This was a coup. This was a coup of a president of the United States. He didn't want to leave, and they said, we can do it the nice way, or we can do it the hard way.
Trump also railed on the current president's foreign policy moves while in office, touching on the situation between Russia and Ukraine. He says Kiev doesn't have enough manpower to continue this fight.
I'm no fan of his, and he was a horrible president, the worst president in history. And one of the reasons he was so bad, first of all, the Israeli attack would have never happened. Russia would never have attacked Ukraine. And we'd have no inflation, and we wouldn't have had the Afghanistan. You take a few of those events away, and we have a different world. Many more people have been killed in Ukraine than you read about. You don't read about how bloody it is and how deserted.
Sure.
Hey, look, just in the two armies, you lost 500,000 people. If you think about it, Russia's gone, you know, Russia defeated Germany with us, and they defeated Napoleon. You know, they've been around a long time. They're a big fighting force.
Yeah.
And Ukraine now doesn't have enough men. They're now using young men and very old men to fight. And we're in a very bad position. A smart president could have stopped that. It wouldn't have happened.
All right, so let's bring in Manila Chan. And Manila, good to have you here. This interview, just another opportunity for Trump to appeal to voters, right? But once again, he focused on attacks on U.S. President Biden. Does the campaign have a messaging problem with when he continues to focus on Biden, or is that part of the strategy, to say this is just a continuation of Biden if you vote for Harris?
Yeah, all of it was a little weird. But Ben, as we know, those who are Trump supporters will support the ex-POTUS regardless of what he says. But the Twitter or the X spaces with Elon will be judged based on whether or not you have orange-colored glasses on. Now, that live call was tuned into by millions of people from around the world. Now, some estimates putting that number closer to 20 million people when you tally up all the different live feeds by YouTubers and people on Rumble. Notable people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and other members of Congress were all listening in to the average Joe from all over the country, eagerly awaiting what sort of spectacle might arise from this conversation that's led by Elon Musk, also known for his often outrageous antics online. So while this talk was all over the place, ranging from Trump's positions on anything from the ongoing conflict in Ukraine to the domestic economy, to even comparing Kamala Harris to his own wife, Melania, the fact that the talk bounced around like a game of Pong, and maybe I'm dating myself there, was actually a feature. It's a feature. It's not a bug, Ben.
Yeah.
With Elon Musk citing that he could actually have a conversation with Trump, unlike Biden or Harris, which presumably Musk has had the opportunity to do so on many occasions. So it's arguable that the Trump-Vance campaign doesn't have a messaging problem. Rather, it's that they have so many and they haven't whittled it down to a narrow focus at this point. However, worth noting, Ben, is that the new Harris campaign has not provided any of their positions on any particular items, their aims, their goals, their platform on any major topics plaguing the country, much less the world, nowhere to be found on the campaign website.
That's right.
Nor has she even had any off-the-cuff interviews with the media. So Musk later went on to tweet that he would like to host Harris on a Spaces as well, Ben.
Yeah, that would actually be, I think, much more interesting than the Trump one, because we don't know any of her positions on virtually anything. And also the fact that she doesn't not only seem to have a stand on anything, but she'll say, day one, I'll start doing this. You're in office now, right? She's running like she's the upstart candidate and he's the incumbent, is the way she's running right now. It's actually a pretty good strategy. But it's interesting. Now, I have another question for you, but before I do a comment, I just want to get your opinion. Elon Musk is a terrible interviewer. Like, this was one of the worst interviews to listen to, don't you think? It's so hard to listen. I love Elon Musk. I think he does a lot of really interesting things. I think he's an incredibly smart person.
Yeah.
He is a horrible interviewer the whole time. It's so hard to listen to him and Trump going back and forth. To me, that was the hardest part of listening to 2.5 hours of stuttering and stumbling.
Well, Ben, I'll just say this much. I don't think you or I are at threat of ever losing our jobs to Elon Musk. Not that I think he can even
handle
yet another job.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, let me ask you this. The alleged cyber attack, by the way, that started off on this whole thing, because I was trying to listen in, as probably you were too, Manila, at 8 p.m. Eastern, and you couldn't get on this thing, right? You took 40 minutes to get on.
Right.
It wasn't the only hurdle in the interview. Before the sit-down, the EU commissioner sent out this kind of veiled threat to Elon Musk, saying that the European Union will be closely watching for any incitement of hatred or violence. I mean, listen, the EU, this is obviously what they do, right? Their obsession with speech. Just kind of another example, I guess, of questionable responses out of Europe after the riots in the UK last week sparked a deadly knife attack. Misinformation about the suspect fueled social media, prompted the UK government to urge citizens to think before you post. But this idea, Manila, it's all thought crime. It's like, we don't like you saying certain things. And the standard they've put on Elon Musk and Twitter, very different than they have on Google or as they have on Meta. Again, this idea that you're thrown in jail for expressing discontent online. And again, everything you heard that news anchor read there, Manila, it is so questionable because it's all relative, right? You posted information and images that stirred up feelings in people, and that's now a crime? And it's all so ambiguous, is it not?
Well, Ben, the Constitution and the First Amendment is a beautiful thing to have. Look, although we saw Brexit happen over 4 years ago, there's really not much daylight between Thierry Breton, what he's saying, and what Great Britain is saying when it comes to freedom of speech. So Thierry Breton is the EU commissioner for internal markets. It's his job, they say, is to shape how people obey a set of rules that the European Commission sets out, specifically on the DSA, the Digital Services Act, which they cite as an online safety protocol aimed at curbing misinformation online. Now, critics of the DSA, they argue this is merely a censorship tool with language too broad, and it would give governments wide breadth for interpreting so-called misinformation or even hate speech. The latter is what we're seeing as a wide net that's being cast across the UK, basically criminalizing dissent from anything that strays from approved government orthodoxy. Now, Breton at the commission is now picking a fight with Elon Musk directly, saying that if Musk doesn't, in effect, censor people like the original Twitter did, well, then the EU is just going to go fine him 6% of X's global revenue, not just that, you know, coming from the EU. Yeah. So Musk, so far, has responded by what else, Ben? Trolling Breton on Twitter, posting the letter Breton sent him online, vowing not to back down in defense of free speech. And worth noting, Ben, George Orwell, the iconic author of 1984, was British. So, you know, maybe he was just way, way, way ahead of his time.
Yeah, he certainly was. By the way, Elon Musk trolling him, those are things we love about Elon Musk. May not be a good interviewer, but he trolls like no one else. All right, let's move to this story here. Russian forces have gained control over parts of the Belovsky region in Kursk following a failed Ukrainian offensive to advance further into Russian-held territory in just the past couple of days. Since the escalation of conflict. Ukrainian officials report substantial losses, with casualties reaching up to 1,600 soldiers. Regardless of one's perspective, the losses on both sides of this war are a profound tragedy. There's no question about that. Well, no question unless you're U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham, who traveled to Kiev on Monday and described the recent developments and those deaths as beautiful.
What I think about Kursk, bold, brilliant, beautiful. Keep it up. Putin started this, kick his ass. Bottom line is to the administration, I appreciate your support. Let these people fight. Give them weapons they need to win a war they can't afford to lose. When it comes to F-16s, way too long. They're here. Let's use them. Let's train Ukrainian pilots. When I talked to President Zelensky just a few minutes ago, if you're a retired F-16 pilot and you're looking to fight for freedom, they will hire you here. They're going to look throughout NATO nations for willing fighter pilots who are retired to come help them until they can get their pilots trained.
I mean, just absorbing all of that, right? The idea that you're going to get these people the weapons, he says, to win a war they can't afford to lose. They can't win it. It's not winnable. And then calling on retired F-16 pilots across NATO nations, including the United States, to go to Ukraine and to fight against the Russians. Right now, Manella, it seems like Russia is still in this position where they're choosing to not advance as aggressively as they could be if they wanted to. They still seem to be doing that. Lindsey Graham's just... it's just like he's churning people up to go over there and get killed.
I mean, Ben, if you're calling up retirees, you're likely signaling to 50-plus-year-old men who have families and lives and have been out of the service for a long time to uproot themselves, to go volunteer, to effectively die in this war. And as you can see there, Ben, behind Lindsey Graham is Senator Richard Blumenthal, a Democrat. He nods along as Graham calls for more arms to Ukraine, suggesting, or I would even say demonstrating, that continued war is a bipartisan topic here in Washington. It's not a promising outlook for peace, I would say, given that, you know, Ukraine just got their hands on some F-16s, but they don't really have any Goose or Mavericks to fly them, Ben. These legacy jets have been used by NATO and the U.S. for over 30 years, but these warplanes are not going to be provided by Washington directly. Around 60 of them have been promised by Belgium, Norway, the Netherlands, and Denmark, but it's going to be a slow trickle on delivery. Many war skeptics see this simply as sort of appeasement of Zelensky, and that the jets won't have real significant impact on battleground conditions, since Russia has air superiority, as well as, in general, the manpower needed to step up the heat. But, Ben, this is also being viewed as the last salvo by Joe Biden, who, along with Lindsey Graham back in 2014, were among the coup cookers in Ukraine.
Yes.
So as the sun sets on the Biden administration, he and that era of cohorts are sort of grasping at ways to salvage this decades-old design by just trying to throw some old pilots into the cockpit for Kiev.
Yeah, it's such a bizarre request to ask, as you said, 50-year-old retirees to go travel to Ukraine and to get into these planes and basically go to your death. Because again, this is not something where Russia has been pushing to take more ground. They're not. I don't know what's happening there, but it certainly appears as if Russia is giving time to finally get to a peace agreement. But it all remains to be seen what happens with the election. Obviously, that's a big part of what this looks like and what it looks like going forward. Manella Chan, thank you so much. All right, we're going to go for a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to dive into these massive protests taking place in Serbia. And in the middle of it all, you guessed it, BlackRock. Of course they are. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Take a fresh look around at life. Kaleidoscopic, isn't it? A shattered reality distorted by power. Tired vision with no real opinions. Pictures designed to simplify or confuse. Who really wants a better world? And is it just for the chosen few? Fractured images presented as fact.
Can you see through their illusions? Going underground can.
counter the Russian state-controlled narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi, c'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
Ukraine never transitioned out of the 90s. The kind of chaotic politics of the 90s continued all the way through. Yeah? And of course, the other thing that Ukraine never had, they never had a Putin. So as you come and assert some stability, assert the power of the state.
Welcome back. I'm Ben Swan. This is Direct Impact. Take a look at this video. Tens of thousands flooding the streets of Belgrade on Saturday, protesting against a planned lithium mine in the country. It was one of the largest demonstrations in Serbia in recent years. The crowd rallied against the involvement of multinational corporations like Rio Tinto and BlackRock, saying that they are exposing the resource-rich region where that mine will be located. So joining me now to help break all of this down, I have geopolitical expert and Serbian resident, Neb Malik. Neb, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
So we've been reading that there have been over 50 protests across the country since just June. Take us through these protests. How large are they? Obviously, from that video there, it's an incredible number of people turning out. Has there been violence? And is the government taking these seriously?
Well, the Belgrade protest from Saturday night was pretty much the most massive one. I believe the police have estimated its size at about 100,000. That was a lot of people. I've never seen anything that big, and it easily outmatched the sheer mass of people that gathered last night to sort of greet the Olympians coming back, you know, Djokovic, Jokic, and the crowd. And that's usually the biggest demonstration in Belgrade any given year. The protests elsewhere in Serbia have been almost as big for their respective regions, and they have not been violent. There has not been any sort of violence. There's been attempts by the political opposition to hijack the protests and sort of divert them into their service of their objectives. The government so far has regarded them as with forbearance and annoyance. They haven't moved very aggressively to break them up. They've basically just cautioned people against any sort of violence and said that the Rio Tinto thing is a done deal and, you know, people shouldn't be fussing over it.
Yeah, well, last month, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz was in Belgrade. He praised that tentative deal between Serbia and the EU for the extraction, the delivery of lithium to the European bloc. You know, the EU kind of sees this deal as a way to become independent of lithium from China and other regions. The problem is this could be, I guess, on one side, an economic boon for Serbia. But there are enormous environmental concerns, and we know this, right? Lithium mining is not clean in any way. In fact, the lithium that we use for batteries and we use for all this clean technology is actually incredibly destructive to the environment in order to extract it, is it not?
Well, from what I've seen analysis-wise, Rio Tinto basically intends to dig this enormous open pit, process the dirt from it using sulfuric acid, extract the lithium and then dump the leftovers sort of either in the same pit or off to the side and not really do any sort of cleanup. The company hasn't said they would do otherwise. The government hasn't said they would do otherwise. And one of the biggest problems is that however much high quality this lithium is, it's right under some amazing both natural beauty and prime agricultural land. And prime agricultural land is one of those things that's in very short supply.
Yeah, and that's a global problem, right? It's not just a Serbian issue. Globally, having strong agricultural land. But Serbia, in terms of history here, you know, in terms of European countries, it still maintains very strong ties with Russia and with China. It's kind of a rogue within Europe in that regard. Right now, Serbia's president is about to approve a massive deal to deliver that lithium, though, to the EU. So is that part of the concern here, is in regards to kind of the geopolitics of it? Or does the average Serbian person not really care about that part? They're more concerned about agriculture, food, environment.
Well, the fact that Germany is sort of the point country of the EU on this project is incredibly troubling, because Germans have a history of invading Serbia twice in the 20th century, and also at the end of the century as part of NATO's armada in 1999, and breaking up Yugoslavia in the 1990s. And so having Scholz come here and say, oh, thank you for giving us the raw resources that we need, also there will be environmental consequences, but not for us, it did not go well. It went over like the proverbial lead balloon in the Serbian public. And I think that's one of the reasons 100,000 people took the streets of Belgrade on Saturday.
You know, it's interesting that you said that, because I think at the core of what's happening here, the players who are most involved in this have no real ties to Serbia, right? Other than the Serbian government giving permission here. But as you said, on the point person for this is Germany on the EU side. And then you have companies like BlackRock who are involved in this. And when you have those kinds of multinational corporations that are coming in and they're taking advantage, you have outside foreign governments that are taking advantage. What are the people to think other than the fact that they're being hoodwinked through all this?
Right. I mean, the Serbs do think that they're being colonized, and it might theoretically be easier if the colonizer was somebody from a friendly country. But considering that the EU has done nothing but blackmail and abuse Serbia for the past 25 years, it's a tough pill to swallow.
Yeah, for sure. You know, we've talked about the kind of the legitimate concerns of protesters, but those of us working in alternative media, all too familiar, and I know you are too, Neb, with the color revolution playbook. Are there bad actors, do you think, in these protests who are kind of seeking to overturn the current Serbian government? Is there an effort right now to get one that's totally aligned with Western Europe and one that's more aligned with the United States? Do you think that's happening?
Well, the pro-Western opposition tried their hand at general elections and failed miserably earlier this year. Basically got wiped out and got very few seats in the parliament as well as local governments. They blamed election fraud, which was never proven. And their activists keep coming up in these, they keep turning up in these protests like a bad penny, trying to divert the crowd's energy and sort of, you know, channel it to their own pet causes. They don't really care about lithium, just like they didn't care last year about kids getting shot up in schools. They just use whichever cause they embrace on a daily basis to help them overturn the government. And in this instance, the Russians actually sent Belgrade an official warning through their intelligence, saying that, you know, there are people trying to use this as a screen for a color revolution. And I would like to remind our viewers that Serbia was actually the place where the first modern color revolution took place back in October 2000. That was the U.S. test of the playbook for winning other people's elections, as one journalist described it. And then they later used the same template and implemented it in Georgia and then in Ukraine twice and other places. So Serbians are very, very sensitive to any sort of mention of color revolution, because they've been through this once and they don't want to go through that again.
Yeah, you know, we started this interview and you said at a certain point, the president of the country, the government is essentially saying to these protesters, you can protest, you can be mad, this is a done deal. Is that the reality of it, or is there any opportunity, do you think, any chance that this deal does go away if enough people stand against it, or is it pretty much guaranteed this is going to happen, this lithium mine?
Honestly, I'm a little baffled by the fact that the Serbian government, which is very PR savvy, is sort of fumbling this really badly and not selling it to the people, aside from, you know, saying shut up and enjoy us being a German lithium colony, in effect. So part of me thinks that one of the strategies might be to sort of see how big these protests get and then tell the Germans in the EU, look, you know, the people are on the edge of revolting here. We can't go ahead and proceed with this. But you never know. I mean, Rio Tinto isn't supposed to start doing anything for another 2-3 years. And that's an eternity politically in Europe these days.
It is an eternity. So they're you're saying there's a chance, it sounds like. There is a chance that if these protests are big enough and then it gives enough political cover to the regime, they're able to push back against the EU? Because it seems like right now they don't have a lot of room to do that.
Well, the EU is sort of holding Serbia hostage because we're surrounded by NATO members. We're surrounded on almost entirely by EU members. And if they decide to impose some sort of economic blockade, even though it will hurt them immensely, it would certainly cause some hardship here. Serbia has managed to be sort of an oasis of free trade between the EU and on one side and like Russia and China on the other, using its neutral status and its politics of non-interference in the Ukraine conflict. But if Brussels decides to be suicidal, as they have been regarding energy from Russia, for example, then, you know, there will be some definite tough times ahead for everybody.
Definitely so. And as you said, you know, it's a very difficult place right now to be neutral politically in any part of the world, especially in Eastern Europe right now. It's a very difficult place, surrounded by NATO, the U.S., Western Europe pushing very hard for all kinds of regime change all over the world. So an interesting conversation. Nev Malik, thank you so much for your time and your insight on this.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, that is our show for today. We want to remind you that we're here every day keeping an eye on the stories that have a direct impact. We'll see you next time.